basically, we think that connected home fitness is here to stay, and the gym industry and the boutique fitness in-person industry will contract.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
I used to have a gym I went to all the time. I loved it. It was great. And then March 2020 happened, and like many people, I started focusing more on at-home fitness. It's been a huge category of late, which naturally attracts competition and innovation. Ergata is one of those innovators that jumped onto my radar recently. They combine elegant cardio equipment with an interactive gaming experience that delivers challenging, competitive, full-body workouts at home, obviously. We tracked down Tom Ouellette, the founder and CEO of Ergata, to talk with us about the future of at-home fitness, identifying a gap in an established market, whether at-home fitness is a fad or a trend, and how to convince people to try something new, like at-home rowing, sight unseen. So with that, let's jump right in. So Tom, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for having me here. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. I figured it's always good to ask people this. I start out with this. Who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis? How do you define your work?
Yeah. So who am I and what do I do? So I run a company called Ergata, or I help run a company called Ergata. So I guess my job title is co-founder and CEO. On a day-to-day basis, what that looks like is a lot of like prioritization definition, kind of working with heads of departments and other folks that run the company to define and measure what it is that we want to prioritize doing. And then a bunch of recruiting, a bunch of fundraising, and a bunch of like marketing work. Yeah.
Which I know is obviously got to be difficult because there's such a, you know, obviously a lot of people are adapting to fitness at home, and we've seen a lot of at-home fitness solutions hit the market recently. So you have your, you know, of course, work cut out for you in terms of differentiation, but tell me, you know, from your perspective, how is Ergata different?
Yeah, totally. So I guess, first of all, it's a rower. It's not a bike. It's not a treadmill. It's not something else. Rowing, for those of you who haven't tried it, is just objectively a better workout than biking and running. You burn calories at a faster rate. You work out more muscles in your body. You do not hurt your knees. And then critically, for at-home workouts, you can tip it up vertically and store it compactly. So it's just a better, more fulsome, more efficient, more kind of long-term sustainable workout than a lot of the competitive modalities. So that's the first thing, is that rowing, kind of the quality of the workout. Two is just the way that it looks. Like it's literally, the design was done by a furniture designer. The material, the main material, is cherry wood. So it is designed. I live in a small New York apartment. It's designed to go in a living space and look good, like in a living room, in a bedroom, in an office. Like most of our customers don't have a separate home gym. So it has to fit aesthetically and physically in the home, which ours I think does. The third thing, and this is the most interesting and frankly the most innovative thing about our product, is what happens on screen, right? So most of the folks in connected home fitness and even just digital fitness apps stream fitness classes in some way, shape, or form. Like what happens on screen is there is an instructor, that instructor does something and verbally motivates you, and you follow along with it. We do not do that. Our core thesis is that not everyone wants that. We have found a different customer in the market. They skew male, they skew introverted, they skew competitive. That does, you know, this is not the person that's in the front row at a SoulCycle class. And so we've gotten to know those people really well. We've gotten to know what they like, what they don't like, what motivates them, what gets them out of bed in the morning, what gets them to work out and makes that a habit-forming activity. And we've designed a content solution around them and the kind of we call it kind of a gaming inspired content solution. The ethos is that we believe that it should feel like a sport. Like using an Ergata feels like you are playing a sport on an ongoing basis during the workout. So that's the kind of core motivating impulse behind the content. The actual tools that we use are that of like gaming, fantasy sports, social networking, right? So the actual workouts are presented in the form of games. You could be racing other people, you could be working out by yourself, working to hit personalized targets, you know, but you are playing a game, you get a score at the end, you kind of can rank yourself relative to your own past performance, relative to other people's performance. You're not doing a class, you're not following along, you are actively participating in a game. And so it's a much more kind of self-directed, competitive, achievement metrics-oriented, interactive experience. And that is really, and as you can tell, it's kind of a difficult one to articulate, honestly, but it's that is the core thing that makes us different. That's the most exciting thing we're doing.
Yeah, and I think there's a lot there. It seems like, obviously, of course, a lot of thought clearly goes into launching something like this. And now I'm wondering, how does market research help a company like yours, but obviously if you're giving advice to other people as well, figure out what to develop in the first place, and also striking a balance between being led by the consumer while still having your own vision for what to build? Because in your case, you did set out to, actually build something in a competitive market, but to build your own thing that would really stand out a little bit against everything else.
I love that you've led with that question, because that is the most important bit of advice that I have for anyone that wants to start a company. Is everyone does like market research. Like, they look at the competition, they look at third party research, they, speak to some experts, whatever. Like, everyone does that. I think the thing that most people don't do is primary market research. So you should speak to at least 100 would-be customers of this product. That is the way that you get unique, interesting insights. That's the way that you understand something about the world or about consumer behavior, about business behavior that everyone else doesn't already know and understand. That is the unique source of insight that propels a company to being valuable and propels a new solution onto the market. So that, I think it's like hundreds of interviews, like structured interviews with the right people. And you kind of isolate who those people are over time and kind of build up hypotheses. And then you can do some more quantitative kind of survey work once you kind of have some specific hypotheses to test. But that is, I think no one should start a business without doing that for like 3 months. And then to your other question about like, how do you balance the two? I think that is like a really good question. And I don't have all the answers. It's something we kind of, there's some push and pull on a weekly, monthly basis, honestly, within our company. The way that we've solved it is by defining the guardrails, basically. Like, we've clearly defined a vision, right? Working out should feel like you're playing a sport, not taking a class. We've clearly defined a more concrete set of product principles, like, this is the nature of the products that we make, right? Like, it's competitive, it's personalized, workouts are games, not, whatever. And we've clearly defined who the customer is. And we've also defined a couple things that we don't do or that are not, don't have strategic value to us. Like, you would never buy an Ergata because of X. So I think you set out those guardrails clearly in advance. You write them down. Everyone that joins a company, you tell them, they're in the pitch deck, they're in the onboarding materials, they're in all the product work. Whenever we do product prioritization, we first talk about them and then we move on. So, and then within that, all the details are up for negotiation and we largely defer to the customer. But like, the way that you define the vision and the product principles and the guardrails is after you do a bunch of primary market customer research. But then you do have to lock a strategy. You have to look at the competitive landscape. You have to see where the puck is going for the industry. But then once you lock that in, those don't change. And then all the details are subject to customer research, ideation, et cetera.
Talking about being an innovator, how does an innovator like yourself identify a gap in an established market? In your case, looking at home fitness and saying, yes, but are we, as a industry addressing a particular user? In your case, like, you did that work, but how does an innovator even start to, wrap their head around that problem?
Yeah, I guess I have three thoughts on this. One is that it just helps to be an industry outsider. Like, coming to a new industry with frameworks from old industries just helps. Whatever. It just helps. You're less kind of set in the ways of the industry. And so you can kind of, you're just better positioned to innovate, I think. The second thing, and it's obviously related to the first thing, is like, challenge the fundamental assumptions. Like, don't assume things. Like, anytime you find yourself assuming something, like, make sure you validate that, right? And I think this is related to number one, because when we came into fitness, like, we just didn't know the industry that well. So we asked very fundamental questions and we learned things that were really surprising to us that, like, a lot of the industry insiders, like, either didn't know or didn't think was true, or like, didn't appreciate as much as we thought, as much as we did. At least that was our perspective. So I think starting with extremely fundamental questions in your conversations with would-be customers, and don't assume anything, and notice anytime you find yourself assuming something and kind of like challenge that. That I think really helps. And then the last thought is I mentioned it before, but primary market research, like that's the way that you get unique insight. If you're just Googling, if you're just reading third-party reports and you're just talking to the experts, like everyone else has already done that and everyone else already knows that. The way that you get actual unique insight is spending 3 months speaking to would-be customers and kind of finding out new things.
And what's interesting now is I feel like, because of course you have to talk to customers, but that there's so much that's up in the air about how they're going to act in the future. Like you can ask a lot of people when gyms open again, for instance, are you going to rush back into the gym? And some people say, you know, like people will answer that all different ways, but how do they know until they're, you know, posed with that situation? And I know actually people are still wary of visiting gyms and they're increasingly looking to have like at home effective fitness solutions. But how long do you expect that trend to continue? Because I'm sure that's something that obviously ties into your business model of, you know, like, will that continue forever? Will people just get used to working at home and they just won't want to, you know, get out there again?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts about this. And I think, you know, there'll be different people that follow different behavior patterns. But fundamentally, I think that for most people, in most cases, working out from home is a more compelling solution. So, and this is just, you know, if you can deliver substantially the same experience to consumers in a way that is much more convenient for them, they'll take some time to change your behavior, but they'll end up doing the more convenient thing. And that's what working out, you know, that's what working out from home is, you know, and the software and the content is what makes it substantially the same.
I think, by the way, sorry to interrupt.
I
think that, especially as you're talking about your unique profile of a customer, if they're in a place that's like a city with that has a lot of people around, you can't go to a gym where it's not going to be busy. So you're going to
totally
still have some of that paranoia. If you're in the suburbs and you can go to the gym and three other people are there and it's a giant gym, you know, that might be an entirely different situation. So
yeah, totally. And I like, and part of this is COVID, but part of it's not. Like I think like COVID just accelerated the adoption of digital home workouts. Like the writing, and this is part of the reason why we started the business, the writing was on the wall in terms of fitness activity migrating into the home. Like if you could make it not suck, people were going to do that. Most people are going to do that most of the time. And back to the primary market research thing, the thing that struck, two things that struck us as newcomers to the fitness industry was how important it was to people. It was like, for like 60% of people, it was like critical to their day-to-day well-being, which means like, you know, they'll pay a lot of money for something that works, right? It's important enough. And the second thing was how much convenience mattered. Like that was by far the most important thing to people when evaluating their fitness solution, we found. So you know, we think that connected home fitness is here to stay and the gym industry and the boutique fitness in-person industry will contract. Now that said, not everyone. Like there were some people that just don't want to work out in the home. I think that will be a minority. And I also think for most people, it will be a hybrid model, right? Like, you know, their kind of workhorse during the week fitness solution, you know, 3-4 times a week will be at home and digital. And then on the weekend, when they have a bit more time, they'll meet up with friends and they'll go play basketball or go to a fitness class or they'll go hike a mountain. Or like, I think there is a social and experiential, like get out of the house component to fitness that is real, but you just, most people can't do that every day. And most people want to break a sweat most days, I think.
Yeah. Well, especially if they're more sedentary, they just have to, you know. And, you know, one thing I thought that was really interesting about your models, you know, I read that about a third of your early customers hadn't been on a rowing machine before purchasing an Ergata, which I found interesting. How do you convince people when it's a newer behavior, you know, like rowing, to convince people to spend about, let's say, $2,000 on something that they're not as familiar with?
Totally. I honestly, that was surprising to us. We thought that that would happen in the medium to long term, but not immediately, not in the short term. So I honestly don't know. I think we're figuring that out. I think, you know, making it look nice goes a long way. You know, a lot of the rowing machines that people see in the gym kind of look like torture devices and you know, making it look nice goes a long way. And, you know, I think just rowing's been mismarketed. So I think just like changing the brand and the look and the feel and the vibe and the language, like this is not the Harvard crew team, right? This is not the torture device in the corner of the gym that's like intimidating and weird and unappealing. Like just the look and feel and the brand around the thing really matters and changes perceptions. I think that's my best answer, but the short answer is I don't really know yet, and we're kind of figuring this out, and we're kind of early in the marketing process.
But it's interesting because I think that it goes along with your philosophy of in some ways following the data. I mean, even the fact that if you can be surprised by a data point, means that you're open to being
totally
surprised by some of it. So, you know, another surprise, I think, for a lot of people is that there were still a lot of startups that were raising funds, you know, throughout the pandemic. And I know you recently raised a few million. How hard is it to raise money in a pandemic? We have a lot of entrepreneurs listening to the show.
Yeah, that was an interesting one. And it was my first time raising venture money. So, you know, take it with a grain of salt. But right when COVID happened, everyone kind of froze up and it seemed very hard to get a deal done because there was just too much financial uncertainty and people were like uncomfortable doing deals entirely over Zoom, whatever. But then after like 2 or 3 months, it was fine. Like venture money's flowing. People are writing a ton of checks. Every venture fund I know is doing really, really well. It was honestly fine. As a founder, like you want to partner with people that you like and that you trust and that see the world in the same way as you. And it's kind of hard to get all the vibe of that over Zoom, but it's not substantially harder. There's the venture funds have kind of gotten over it and they're doing deals over Zoom.
You know, people who went from New York to San Francisco for a half an hour meeting, basically, you know, with potential investors, and then they flew right back. And obviously that's inefficient, but in totally. Some ways it kind of conveys the importance of this was important enough for me to go do that. And once you take that out of the realm of possibility, a lot of people got comfortable pretty quickly. But what's interesting to me is there's still a lot of investors who are less comfortable with the idea of investing in hardware, if you will, versus yeah. software. And how do you get around that? And also, how does the fact that you have a physical product impact the potential scalability of something?
Yeah, I think some investors are not comfortable with hardware and you just have to get that information out of them up front and stop trying. Like you just remove the 50% that are not comfortable with hardware and focus elsewhere. Like there's only so many people that are going to see the world the same way as you and kind of buy into the vision. Or if everyone thought that already, this business would exist. So I think you just suss out that information and kind of move on from people that don't like hardware. Scalability. I mean, you know, we are growing incredibly rapidly and we will this year, we will the year after that. And we are a hardware business. You know, there's more money and logistics and complexity that goes into scaling really quickly when you're a hardware business, but you know, we'll grow 5 to 10x this year as a hardware business. So like you can still grow incredibly quickly as a hardware business. I think we are fundamentally more of a software business. Like the core thing that we are doing that is different and interesting. And if you polled Ergata members and said, what is amazing about Ergata, they would, you know, and we do this obviously, like more than 90% of them, the first thing you'd say is the software, the content, the community, like basically what happens on screen. So I think, you know, I wouldn't want to be in basically a hardware only business. I think what's been exciting about our business is having a core insight that's fundamentally like a software and a content insight, and then integrating that into a holistic experience that is really exciting and kind of holistic for the consumer, and integrating the hardware and the software realm. But yeah, I think it's harder. Like it's harder to scale quickly, and there's like a lot of annoying things that don't exist in software only businesses. But it also acts as a moat. Like there's fewer people will do the thing when bringing a hardware product to market like this takes 2 years. Like competitors can't enter with a couple engineers, you know, in a month, right?
Yeah, which kind of makes it a positive in some ways, right?
Yeah,
I never really thought about it that way, but you're right. It's the barriers to entry are that much higher because of the commitment people have to make up front to it. You know, so another thing I want to ask you is when you're trying to raise money or just convince people that you're onto something that will be bigger tomorrow than it is today as a category, you know, does being a first-time founder work against you or for you? Because like you said, you got to look at things with a fresh set of eyes than some people who might have been at a larger entrenched player.
Yeah, I think it works against you. I think if you've done this before and if you're an industry expert, that builds credibility. Has been my experience. So, you know, they're in the business venture capitalists of kind of analyzing risk and seeing opportunity. And like when you've done it before, I think they think there's less risk. If you know the industry, I think they think there's less risk. So I think it works against you. I think it works for you in terms of actually building the business and actually innovating and actually creating value. But I think optics and raising money is very kind of optics driven. I think the optics are less good.
Yeah, I always tell people the chip on the shoulder kind of aspect of anything, it makes it that much likely. Not saying that you have that, but you know, there are a lot of people who they've got that thing to prove.
Yeah.
In that sense, that just makes it more likely that they are to succeed at, you know, creating the thing they're trying to create.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree with that. The investors don't always see it that way, but I totally agree that's to your benefit, I think.
Yeah. Yeah. No, but this is really interesting. I think obviously it's a high growth area, and everybody listening to this should go take a look. And I think at the very least, you can certainly see that the design, there's love that goes into the design. And this is the thing that I got to say, when people can actually go over to other people's houses again, you know, it will be a conversation piece for a lot of folks who haven't had anybody over in a while. So
totally. I hope so. I think so. And I hope so.
Well, Tom, thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me on, Jeremy. Great to be here. Great to meet you. And yeah, thanks again.
Thanks again to Tom for making the time. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get the show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio, and assistant producer Aaron Cohen. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.